Judges chapter 2 from verse 11 to verse 16. This is the word of God. Then the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord and served the Baals. They forsook the Lord, the God of their fathers, who had brought them out of Egypt. They followed and worshipped various gods of the peoples around them. They provoked the Lord to anger because they forsook him and served Baals and the Ashtoreths. In his anger against Israel, the Lord handed them over to raiders who plundered them. He sold them to their enemies all around, whom they were no longer able to resist. Whenever Israel went out to fight, the hand of the Lord was against them to defeat them, just as he had sworn to them. They were in great distress. Then the Lord raised up judges who saved them out of the hands of these raiders.
Well, good morning. And you see me standing here, and it's possible if you caught wind of who I am this morning, you might have been particularly impressed. You might have thought, wow, how did David scoop him? And I guess I could understand it if you were a little starstruck when you caught a glimpse of me. I wonder, did anyone actually do that? Get a load of that. When I walked in the room. And I wonder now if you're forming questions that you want to ask me at morning tea. Perhaps you've heard about my leadership capacities. Maybe you've heard something about my strategic thinking. Or you're into ultimate fighting and so you want to hear about my close combat fighting prowess of younger days. Or perhaps you've heard about how God used me. And you've got questions about that. Now, if all of that sounds a bit bold and a little bit offensive, I really only said it to gear you up for what's coming. Because what I want to say this morning will strike some of you as bold and offensive. Of course, of all the things that might have piqued your interest about me, I suspect that for most, if not for all of you, you would realise that the man standing before you is left-handed. I mean, that's the moniker that I just can't seem to shake. You would think that after all the things that have happened in my life, that the first thing that you're made aware of me beyond my name is more substantial than the fact that I'm left-handed. Well, it's not like I expect you to feel sorry for me. I mean, I've got used to it, as you sit there, most of you potentially right-handed with your smug look of never having had to battle with a can opener. I'm used to it. And of course, maybe I could cope with it all the more, this being left-handed, if it wasn't for the fact that God seems so taken with the right hand. And if you're right-handed, you've probably never noticed it. Probably took it for granted along with your comfortable scissors and your unsmudged writing. Your right hand, O Lord, was majestic in power. Your right hand, O Lord, shattered the enemy. You have made known to me the path of life. You will fill my life with joy in your presence, with eternal pleasures at your right hand. The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies a footstool for your feet. I will strengthen you and help you. I will uphold you with my righteous right hand. My own hand laid the foundations of the earth. My right hand spread out the heavens. And to add insult to injury, I'm the son of Jared the Benjamite. Do you hear that? I am Ehud the Benjamite. Do you know what Benjamin means? Son of the right hand. I mean, won't someone give me a break? You might not even think that knowing that kind of information is actually of much value to you. Big deal, he's left-handed. Only it's a significant detail in the story that I want to relate to you. Of course, from the distance where you sit, it will be hard to see if that statement about me being left-handed is just that. I'm telling you I'm left-handed. Or if it's a statement that says something about an incapacity in my right hand. In my mother tongue, when we say that someone's left-handed, we're saying something like a tied right hand, a bound right hand. So does it suggest the possibility that I'm disabled in my right, crippled? So it isn't that you see my able left hand, but the blemished, broken, useless right hand. Are you meant to look at me and see someone weakened? Someone passed over, the kid in the class who's least likely to pose a threat? hardly the image of a man that might instill fear or engender respect. Is that what you're meant to see when you hear that I'm left-handed? Or, to confuse things maybe even more, another option, is it a reference that would have you believing that I'm not naturally left-handed, but that my right was bound so I might gain dexterity in my left? That is, that I'm ambidextrous, that there's more to me than meets the eye. Well, let's just leave that hanging for now. I'd rather cut to the chase and tell you the story, a story that comes right out of left field. It is a most surprising and perplexing tale. You'd also say that it's ingenious, that it's comical, grotesque and violent. It's got something for everyone. Allow me to take you back. How far? Let's go to Moses. You'll have heard of him. He's the guy that God sends to Egypt when God's people, when my people, my ancestors are held in slavery. He's sent by God to confront the Pharaoh. And ultimately, Moses is the one who will lead God's people out of the land of slavery and into the land of promise. Of course, it takes 40 years and Moses dies before he sets foot in the place. And the baton is then passed across to Joshua. And he will be the one who will lead the nation in the conquest of the promised land. It'll take a conquest because the promised land's not empty. And the instructions to my ancestor Joshua couldn't have been clearer. God said, I will give you every place where you set your foot, as I promised Moses. Your territory will extend from the desert to Lebanon, and from the great river Euphrates, the Hittite country, to the great sea to the west. No one will be able to stand against you all the days of your life. As I was with Moses, so I will be with you. I will never leave you, nor forsake you. And so Joshua and God's people went in and they took the land, only they didn't take it completely. And eventually Joshua dies. And so there we are, God's people in God's land, only we're not alone. And God's people start to worship the gods of the people they were meant to get rid of. This pleases not the God of our forefathers. We should have listened to Joshua's dying words. He said, but if you turn away and ally yourself with the survivors of these nations that remain among you, if you intermarry with them and associate with them, then you may be sure that the Lord your God will no longer drive out these nations before you. Instead, they'll become snares and traps for you, whips on your backs and thorns in your eyes until you perish from this good land which the Lord your God has given you. And of course, that's exactly what happened. You'd have to say that life in the land isn't always pleasant. In fact, repeatedly my people are threatened and attacked and taken over by the other nations. Who's in charge, you ask? Short answer is no one. Not really. Don't we have a king? No, we didn't need a king. God was to be our king, only we weren't very good at being his subjects. Seemingly, we easily forgot him. I don't know if that's anything that you would know anything about. But here's the damning summary of us. The Israelites lived among the Canaanites, the Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites. We took their daughters in marriage and gave our daughters to their sons and served their gods. And I'm here to tell you that all that's not without consequence. The Lord's anger would burn against us. He would raise up an oppressor. We were in bondage, enslaved. And then the people would cry out to God. And he'd appoint a judge, a deliverer, to lead and save his people. The deliverer would do just that. There'd be peace until the deliverer died. And then Israel would sin again and God would raise up an oppressor, and around we'd go. Seemingly there was this terrible cycle. And that's where I fit in. There was a judge before me, Othniel. He was empowered by God to defeat the king of Aram, and he brought in a peace, period of peace for 40 years. And then he died. And true enough, my people did evil in the eyes of the Lord. And this time, an unexpected thing happened. The king of Moab joined forces with the Ammonites and the Amalekites to attack us. And they defeated us. And the king of Moab set himself up in Jericho, in the city of palms, the very place of our great victory, well, the very place of God's great victory. Jericho now under a foreign ruler. Why is this unexpected? Because we're talking about Moab. They were meant to be afraid of us. Moses sang a song about it. The chiefs of Edom will be terrified. The leaders of Moab will be seized with trembling. The people of Canaan will melt away. And they were. When my people first approached their territory on the way to the promised land, they were freaked out by us. Oh, they cover the face of the earth. This horde is going to lick up everything around us like an ox licks up the grass of the field. Why is Moab so unexpected? Well, because Moab isn't even part of the promised land. They weren't even on our radar screen. More than that still, these guys are our cousins. They're descendants of Abraham's nephew Lot. They're part of the family. Kind of. Who would have expected Moab? And well, now we're under the rule of a Moabite king, Eglon. And we become his vassal. We're subject to him. And he is God's agent of judgment on us. Make no mistake. It was because of the evil that we had done before God's very eyes that Yahweh gave Eglon, king of Moab, power over us. Year after year, he had power over us. For 18 years. Do you picture that? Would it surprise you to know that my name, Ehud, means "where is the splendor?" Kind of sums up the vibe at this point in our history. Where is the splendor? How far have we fallen? And then, like I said, the Israelites cried out to Yahweh, and he gave them a deliverer. Me, Ehud, a left-handed man, son of Jerah the Benjamite. And perhaps you didn't see that coming. I'm not sure how many people did. I was selected and sent to Eglon, the Moabite king. I was to carry him a tribute. It's what people who are oppressed have to do to keep the oppressors happy. It's kind of like a tax, but it's more than that. It's an offering. And why me? Not sure. Some might say that I was sent because my value, both to my own people and to the Moabites, was seen in what I couldn't do. See, if this is a lame arm, then I pose no danger and no threat. My people can send me and have no concern that I'm going to upset the established 18-year-old balance. And Eglon, he can receive me. Look at me, I have no fighting arm. And in saying that, maybe I'm the perfect picture of the situation. You look at Israel, weak and impoverished, bringing their offering. They are helpless and enslaved to the powerful Moab. Well, whatever the rationale was in sending me, it is clear that God will be at work in this. I am, after all, his deliverer. So I'm off to see the king of Moab, tribute in hand. It's worth taking a moment to tell you something about this king. He's fat. Actually, it's hard to overstate how fat he is. He's extremely fat. He's a very fat man. You hear that and you're meant to think of a fattened cow readied for the slaughter. And of course, when you hear his name, Eglon, you're meant to hear little calf or little bull. And maybe you also hear an echo in his name of Agol, of rotund, round. And so before you've even seen him, in your mind's eye, he's a caricature. A rotund little fattened calf. and I'm off to see him with tribute in hand. And I alluded to this a moment ago. You should see this as an offering, because we'd use that same word to talk about the grain offerings to be made to Yahweh. And I was taking it to Eglon. Did you see what's going on here? Do you see the state of the people of Israel? How far from God's provision, his ideal, we are? We're taking that which would be offered to Yahweh, and we're laying it before an engorged Moabite. It is as if he's our God. We're enslaved to this insatiable stomach of gluttonous proportions. This is where our sin has taken us. And it's not just the king who's on the heavy side of a beast. At the end of my story, you'll meet 10,000 Moabites, all vigorous and strong, all able-bodied men. Only those are very kind ways of translating the words for fat and richly fed and wealthy. You're meant to see that Israel is lean and forlorn, supplying the grain while the Moabites bulk up at the all-you-can-eat buffet that we keep filling. See, I'm not telling you that this king and the Moabites are fat to make fun of them. It's bigger than that. It's a picture of our idolatry played out before our eyes. For 18 years, we're in bondage. And look at the one that enslaves us, a fat Moabite. Bring tribute to him. Pay him homage. And look at how he oppresses us. We go without. We cry out for release. And the rotund little fattened calf, the Moabite king, our stomach, belches for more and for more and for more. Is that a graphic enough picture of sin for you? And I don't know if that resonates for you. Does sin look like that for you? Like idolatry? To know that you are made to respond to the God who made you and to serve him only. Only you don't. You turn, like we did, to other gods, to someone or to something else. Maybe to the Baals and the Asherahs, to the gods of the money and the sex and the power. And you serve them and live for them. Worship them. Well, I hope that you can see sin like that. And that it looks a lot like Eglon, king of Moab. Promises so much. Looks so rewarding, enticing, yet is in fact a cruel master that enslaves and is never satisfied and gives you nothing in return. Are you paying tribute to Eglon, offering what belongs to God to a non-God, to a created thing? God may well have given Eglon, king of Moab, power over us, but he didn't sanction this opulence gleaned from the abundance of the land of Canaan, God's inheritance being consumed with total disregard for God and for God's people. So when you hear what I'm about to tell you, I don't want you to think that I'm some kind of vigilante. God is dealing with sin. Eglon has earned what is coming. If I was going to coin a phrase, I'd tell you that the wages of sin is death. Oh, and Eglon, it's payday. Off I go, leading a small party with me. We've got the offering. We go to the city of palms. There is, of course, more being carried than just that tribute. I'd made a sword. It's double-edged. It's about a foot and a half long. It has no hilt. And I've strapped it to my right thigh under my clothing. I present the tribute to Eglon, the king of Moab, who's a very fat man. And we leave, we head home. I sent my men ahead of me, and when I reached the idols near Gilgal, I turned back. Not sure if I'm meant to make too much of this, those idols at Gilgal. But I will say this. Whatever they were, whatever they stood for, they stood on the ground where Joshua had erected 12 stones after God had dried up the Jordan. We were meant to come to those stones and be reminded that the hand of Yahweh is powerful, and to always fear Yahweh our God. They would be a reminder of God's covenant with us. And yet here are idols at Gilgal. Syncretism again. At that point, I turn back to Eglon. I have a secret message for you, O king. And he says, quiet. Which his bouncers understand to mean leave the room, and they go. And so now it's a private audience with the king. He obviously wants to know the secret message and what it is. And I'm ready to deliver it. It's true I didn't announce my intentions to Eglon. But I didn't lie. He heard what he wanted to hear. More fool him. There's a sense to a fatness in his thinking. A buffoon. When I say I have a secret message, there's a double meaning in that. I use the word debar. And true enough, it means message or word, but it also means thing or object or experience. So I say, I have a secret message. I have a concealed object. I have a hidden experience. I approach him while he's sitting alone in his upper room and I say, I have a debar from God for you. Not to suggest that I'm a prophet, but this king is gullible. And little did he know that this message was 18 inches of cold steel strapped to my side. He hears me say this is from God, and he lifts up his enormous mass to his feet. And he exposes that proud, blubbery belly. Then I reach with my left hand to my right side, and I draw the double-edged sword. Could have struck him anywhere and slain him. But his gut is the target. It's an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. It's a belly for the belly. It's a fitting judgment. And I take my hand off the grip. And the belly pushes forward. And the handle sinks in. And it disappears from view beneath the fat. And so in a cruel twist, Eglon's fat turns against him and swallows the sword, denying its removal. And only the tip that has now come out through his back is visible. I went to the porch, I shut the doors behind me, I locked them, I left. After I'd left, Eglon's attendants came back to the upper room. The doors are locked. They don't think foul play. They immediately think of something else that's foul that has taken place. One can only assume that they smell the disemboweled king. But the odour, it doesn't raise their suspicions about an assassination attempt. They merely remark, he must be relieving himself in the upper room of the house. Given the size of this engorged fellow, perhaps it shouldn't surprise us that he be known for extended periods on the throne. His attendants, not wanting to disturb Eglon, they wait. Good news for me. It gives me time to make my escape. They wait, we're told, to the point of embarrassment. You'd love to know how long that is. Is 10 minutes embarrassing? 30 minutes? However long it is, it's long enough for me to get past the idols and escape to Sira. Eventually the attendants do go in, and there's the scene. Their lord fallen on the floor. All that remains of Eglon, the rotund, fattened calf, is a corpse lying in its excrement. When I get to Sira, I blow the trumpet. It echoed in the hill country of Ephraim, and it summoned Israel to stand, to take arms. And led by me, God's deliverer, Ehud, Israel went out to meet the Moabites. Follow me, I ordered. For the Lord has given Moab, your enemy, into your hands. And they followed. Crossed the river Jordan, we allowed no one to cross. And in the battle that followed, we struck down those 10,000 corpulent Moabites. And on that day, right out of left field, the tables were turned and Moab was made subject to Israel. And for the next 80 years, the land had rest. And that's my story. What do you take from this? Doubtless it's a warning to any who would have ears to hear about the seriousness of idolatry, the seriousness of sin. You can see that clear enough from the impact that sin has on my people, on Israel, and on Moab. Yahweh is consistent here. I might look unpredictable, but God doesn't. He's hated sin from the beginning. He still hates it in my story. Pours his wrath on it. And he hears the repentant cry. Has from the beginning, does now. He delivers. He saves. Saves people from the penalty of sin so that they don't live under it, so that they can be freed from having to live serving it. That's at least part of my story. Now, maybe you're tempted to think my story is about how God can use anyone. If that left-handed Ehud can be used by God, then I can be used by God. Look, God can use anyone. But I'd want to say that that's not the point. I'm not the person to emulate. Like I'm some hero who saved the day. Don't you see that it's God whose hand that's written all over this? You ought to be sitting there struggling with me. The best of men are men at best, and I don't think that my story paints me as the best of men. You have reason to see me as deceiving, as violent, as opportunistic. Among other things, I ought to be hard to reconcile with my methods and a story that's really about God again showing himself to be gracious to undeserving people. What you see in my story is Yahweh at work. You know he's the one who's listening to the cries and he's meeting the cries of the people. He's the one in charge. He's the one enthroned. It's a theocracy, this story. Don't underestimate God's sovereignty. He's engaged with sinful humanity. Why? What do you take from this? And I guess you're looking at me and thinking, you are an unlikely saviour, Ehud. Yeah. And I'm looking at you and you're all theological students. And evidently you know things that I couldn't even imagine. And I've got questions for you. See, let's assume that human nature is much the same in your day that it is in mine. And so idolatry must be prevalent for you in yours, right? We were living worshipping the gods of the people around us. Is that the same? Where you devote yourself to what everyone who doesn't know Yahweh is living for? You've got to watch that. It's deadly. It's subtle too. And what kind of an offering do you sacrifice to your false gods? Your crops and cash in hand? Your time, your family, all that ought to belong to God? And let me guess, you pin your hopes and dreams there, you attach your security in it, you find your peace there and love and acceptance there. And let me guess, it's never satisfied. It's an empty stomach at the end of an open mouth. Are you in bondage, oppressed, taking tributes to Eglon? Well, can I ask you something else? Has God sent you a deliverer? Do you need one? Do you know his name? And when he came, did he look like God's right-hand man? Perhaps you're sitting there and thinking, perhaps yes, perhaps no. A little yes, a little no, a little ambidextrous. Do I remind you of him? Perhaps yes, perhaps no. Yes, in the sense that your deliverer is an unlikely saviour. No, in the sense that he's the deliverer par excellence. In him is found no deceit. In him there is no idolatry, no sin. And I take it he brings deliverance not through a bloody coup, but through his own sacrifice. Are you not astounded that your deliverer, the Son of God's right hand, was sent in the likeness of sinful man to be a sin offering? And so God condemned sin in sinful man in order that the righteous requirement of the law might be fully met. Undeserving, unrepeatable, under grace. Oh, to know what you know. That once again God graciously saves by sending an unlikely deliverer. So here, the prophet Isaiah, who has believed our message, and to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed, that he grew up before him like a tender shoot, and like a root out of dry ground, he had no beauty or majesty to attract us to him, nothing in his appearance that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows, familiar with suffering, like one from whom men hide their faces. He was despised, and we esteemed him not. And surely he took up our infirmities and carried our sorrows, yet we considered him stricken by God, smitten by him and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that has brought us peace was upon him, and by his wounds we are healed. We all, like sheep, have gone astray. Each of us have turned to his own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. He was oppressed and afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth. He was led like a lamb to the slaughter, as a sheep before his shearers is silent, so he did not open his mouth. By oppression and judgment he was taken away. And who can speak of his descendants, for he was cut off from the land of the living. For the transgressions of my people he was stricken. He was assigned a grave with the wicked, and with the rich in his death. Though he had done no violence, nor was any deceit in his mouth, yet it was the Lord's will to crush him and cause him to suffer. And though the Lord makes his life a guilt offering, though the Lord makes his life a guilt offering, he will see his offspring and prolong his days. And the will of the Lord will prosper in his hands. After the suffering of his soul, he will see the light of life and be satisfied. By his knowledge, my righteous servant will justify many, and he will bear their iniquities. Therefore, I will give him a portion among the great, and will divide the spoils with the strong, because he poured out his life unto death, and was numbered with the transgressors, for he bore the sin of the many, and made intercession for the transgressors.